Welcome to Countercurrents Radio. This is John Morgan. I'm actually going to be doing a solo podcast this week because Greg Johnson is busy traveling at the moment and Mike Polignano is busy with other tasks. So my guest I'm very honored to have is Frode Midjord, who is the founder and chairman of the Skanza Forum, which is the premier, would you say, the main right-wing metapolitical conference in Scandinavia at the moment. It's a pan-Scandinavian forum. Would that be accurate to say?
Yeah, I think so, yeah. Well, the premier, that's for others to judge, but yeah, we're operating in Scandinavia.
Thank you for joining us, Frode.
Well, thank you for inviting me. I've been following Countercurrents since the first day it went online, so it's good to be on your show.
Wow, that's so you're a long time. You've been with us for over 8 years then.
Yes, I have.
Well, so Frode, I've known you for quite a while now. I've been on your old podcast, Mene Frego, a couple of times, but I don't think you've ever actually been at Countercurrents before, so I'm glad to introduce you to a new audience. Maybe you could tell us a little bit about your background. How did you first get interested in metapolitics and want to become active in the way that you have?
Right. Well, there wasn't really a moment when I sort of realized there were these problems we're dealing with in society with immigration and so on. But I was born on the Faroe Islands. I don't know if Americans are familiar with the Faroe Islands. What would you say? Should I tell them what it is?
I think you should. I mean, I know, but I've been in Europe for a while. I'm a bit more familiar with these things than so. Yeah, why don't you explain that for people?
Yes, so it's a small group of islands in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean, basically north of Scotland, between Scotland and Iceland. So it's 18 small islands, and they were, it's difficult to say when they were first populated, because there are some sort of records of them being populated in the 400s in the 5th century, but the popular now, it came from Norway in the late 800s, so 880s. So you can say that the Faroe Islands is an extension of Scandinavia, with a small population of 50,000 people and sort of semi-independent home rule. It belongs under Denmark, so it's sort of the domestic policy is Faroese, but it belongs under Denmark in foreign policy. It was actually founded by Norwegians, so it's in the Viking ages. Norwegians settled there and. Then when Norway became a part of the union between Sweden, Norway, and Denmark in the 1300s, the colonies, of course, also joined. And when Norway broke away from Denmark in 1814, the colonies, among them the Faroe Islands, stayed with Denmark, so that's why it's a part of the Danish kingdom right now. The culture is, so it's basically a Scandinavian country, although it's in the middle of the ocean.
What language is spoken there?
It's a West Nordic language, Faroese. It's its own language, and it's probably it is closest related to Icelandic. There was another language called Norn that was spoken in on Shetland and Orkney, but it was extinct in late 1800s, I think. So those three are the sort of probably the closest you could get to what the original Viking settlers spoke in the 800s. But like I said, Norn is now extinct, so it's only Faroese and Icelandic left. And there is quite a big difference between them. I could understand Icelandic if I read with a bit of effort, but it's not definitely not fluently.
Mm-hmm.
So I was born there, and it's basically 100% homogeneous, ethnically speaking. So it's no crime, and it's.
Imagine that.
Ethnically
homogeneous and no crime.
Yeah. You wouldn't imagine that was possible, but sure, it is. And
well, I was kind of curious about the situation there just because I was in Iceland a couple of months ago, mm-hmm. and I was distressed to find that they've absorbed a lot of this same, sort of radical leftist ideology that's been rampant in Scandinavia more generally. You know, I would have thought that maybe their isolation would have protected them. And I wouldn't say it's as far advanced as it is in Sweden or Norway, but it was quite a bit of multiculturalism in Reykjavik. Is it the same way in the Faroe Islands have not had that problem?
Multiculturalism is a bit too far, but sure, the sort of political correct tropes are still there. I was there this summer, and they have their own. Tórshavn is the capital, and they have their own Tórshavn pride. You know, a population of 50,000. How many homosexuals? I don't know, 5. You know, but it's still, you know, everyone participates in this parade, and it's sort of a very symbolic thing. So people have a need to signal political correctness there as well. But I think it's always like that in places that don't face the real problems. They don't really understand why people react against the problems. So they become a bit naive. And Iceland, I don't know. Iceland is, George Lincoln Rockwell used to live on Iceland in the 50s.
Well, his wife was Icelandic, wasn't she?
Yeah. So
His first wife.
Yeah, I think she was called Helga. But he stayed there on a military base. I don't know for how long. But in his book, This Time the World, he writes about the Icelandic, and it's especially about the women. He comments that they were sort of more affected by the sort of, what should you call it, sexual unmorality or whatever, you know, more than the American women. So the American soldiers who came there were sort of surprised by what they saw about, you know, very unconservative values in that department. So probably you can't say that it's all, you know, an effect of American Hollywood culture, and it's probably something in Scandinavia that has created this sort of mentality as well. And I think Iceland had the first lesbian prime minister, and they have all these very sort of feminist attitudes as well.
Yes, I did kind of catch a glimpse of that when I was there. But what do you think is, I mean, do the Faroe Islands suffer from the same phenomenon? Because I wonder with Iceland, if it's not because they've been so isolated for so long that when they were sort of finally opened up to the world, maybe that contributed. It was just,
probably.
You know, let's check out this crazy new,
they want to absorb everything.
Crazy other country. Yeah, I mean, I guess you can sort of understand that mentality, even though it's an instinct that should be resisted.
But wasn't it sort of like that in some places, at least in the East, when the wall broke down and they wanted to absorb a lot of American culture and so on?
Yes. My understanding is that when the wall came down, like in Germany, even now, you know, here in Hungary, you know, there's sex shops all over the place.
Yeah.
And you don't see that in the U.S. because I mean, they're around, of course. Well, I think these days, most of that stuff is online, but I feel like, you know, people, they were kind of subjected to this sort of state repression.
Yeah.
Of sexuality, and then when that was lifted, they sort of went too far in the other direction.
They want to go the extra mile.
I guess you could say that. In that, I don't know if you've ever seen the film Goodbye Lenin.
I think I saw it, yeah.
It's a German film, I think about 15 years old. About the wall coming down in East Germany. And like the first thing that a lot of the people do once they get over to the West is, you know, they go to a porno theater.
Yeah.
In one scene. So, I guess, you know, it's something new and different and titillating in that. Not something kind of decadent and disgusting as it is for us.
there's an Icelandic movie called The Devil's Island or something like that, and it's about that, you know, the American culture, people wanting to sort of emulate the American culture and to be hip.
But what would you say, the situation is similar in the Faroe Islands, or is it more connected to the continent, so they wouldn't have this kind of...
The Faroe Islands is more connected to Denmark. So when people go to study at the university, they go to Copenhagen, so it's very connected to Denmark, and it's probably not as isolated. So it's probably more connected. But there is still this sort of need to be a bit hip, hipsterish, and to show people sort of that you're not a hillbilly or whatever you want to call it, you know, that you're not from the countryside, that you're modern and you have modern values. And but immigration, there's basically no immigration. There's, you know, adoption, and people have Thai wives from Thailand and Philippine wives, like in the rest of Scandinavia. I don't know how common that is around the rest of, you know, Europe or the white world, but all over Sweden and Norway and the Faroe Islands, men on the countryside, women move away from the countryside and men get women from Thailand.
That's distressing.
Yeah, it's a very common thing. So if you go to the countryside, you know, in the most remote place in Norway, drive over the mountains and get to a little village somewhere, you'll find a lot of women from Thailand there.
And that's really too bad, because, I mean, Scandinavians, I believe, are among the, you know, sort of the most ethnically pure in all of Europe. So the fact that this is becoming a thing now is troubling.
Yeah, I don't know why exactly Thailand, but it has become a trend over a couple of decades now. You know, the children from those marriages are, I don't know, in their 20s, early 20s probably now. And so this is an ongoing process. Other than that, you don't get any immigration to the Faroe Islands. So when I moved from there, and this hadn't started when I was a child. So when I moved from there, when I was a kid, I moved to Sweden, and I was confronted, you know, by Swedish multiculturalism that has become so well known in the rest of the world. And I just saw the contrast, and I reacted to it, and I immediately felt sort of alienated by the whole attitude of the society and so on. So that was probably when I sort of realized instinctively that this is not what I want. And then when I became a teenager, I sort of got interested in the more subcultural, political, nationalist movements. But they weren't really going anywhere, so I didn't participate all that much. I went to events and things like that, but I didn't seek any sort of very active part in that. And that's basically where my interest for these things. It's basically been an instinctive and it's been a reaction to a situation that I just don't like. Most people, you know, they vote with their feet. They move away from these things, and most people don't like it. But they're just sort of dishonest about them.
Yes. But, I mean, you eventually left Sweden, because I know that now you're in Bergen in Norway.
Yes, but I moved to Norway just 2 years ago.
Have you found the situation there to be different at all, or is it essentially the same?
Well, there is a sort of difference of attitudes between Sweden and Norway. They don't have the same sort of extreme madness, you know, with political correctness and feminism and mass immigration to the same extent as Sweden. But still, there is smaller sort of opportunity for any debate, because they are more conformist. You know the concept, the Janteloven?
I don't actually.
No, it's a Swedish, Scandinavian, yeah, so Swedish, Norwegian, and Danish concept. It's from a book in the 1930s. It's a fictional law, but it's just meant to illustrate the sort of attitude that is very common in Scandinavia, that, you know, keep your head down and shut up and, you know, stay in line, you know? And it's codified in this book that's sort of a parody of it, that, you know, don't think you're better than anyone else, don't think you're special, you know, just stay in your place. And that attitude is a bit more common in Norway, I would say. It's Sweden is more of a polarized society, and when people say very extremely politically correct things in Sweden, they do it. It's a sort of it's a thin veneer. It's they do it with an amount of cynicism, because they say what is expected of them. They sort of pay lip service, And there's a very sort of widespread contempt for politicians in Sweden. The same is, it's not the same in Norway. Norwegians take these politically correct matters more seriously, I would say. And so even though the situation, you know, in brute numbers and so on is slightly better in Norway, I would say the Norwegians are more afraid to speak their minds than Swedes. So in that way, I have slightly larger hopes, or more hope for Sweden, at least in the, in, you know, in the short term future. But it's one explanation, of course, could be that Norway hasn't suffered the same problems for as long as Sweden, so Sweden has had more time to sort of react. But there are different factors, you know, differences between Sweden and Norway that could also explain why this sort of political impotence is so present in Norway, but not in the same way in Sweden. Among other things, Norway has been an independent country for just over 100 years. It used to be part of, an alliance with Denmark and Sweden, and then just with Denmark, and then with Sweden. And during the Black Plague in the 1300s, the entire nobility of Norway was wiped out. So it's always been under, you know, foreign rule to some extent. So the political class, or the ruling class, has not been present. So Norway doesn't have the same sort of political traditions as Sweden and Denmark.
You know, what you said about the modesty of people in Scandinavia, and I would say along with that is the idea of conformity, that yes. You know, a good person should conform to his society is a peculiarly Germanic characteristic, I would say. Like I was in Denmark a year or so ago with a friend of mine, and we were looking at the Parliament building in Copenhagen. Mm-hmm. And it's actually quite a simple building. Yeah. And he commented to me that, well, you know, he said, this is the Germanic mentality, you know, the political leadership, you know, should be modest, because, you know, the grandiosity, you know, that's only for the church. Yeah. But I thought that was interesting. I mean, I think you even see this in Germany. To an extent, it's sort of like a Germanic ideal that you know, you should be humble and sort of modest before God. But the problem is that's sort of been transmuted now to, you know, this new political class that we have, you know, that's trying to shove multiculturalism down our throats.
Yeah, well, it's difficult to say what gave birth to that mentality, because I know that Kevin MacDonald has a theory about, you know, the Ice Age, and other peoples had to deal with basically other tribes fighting against other tribes, whereas the Nordics had to fight against the cruel nature and the cold and so on. And that,
right.
That created a sort of a more openness, and I don't know, that's probably part of the explanation, but still there's a huge difference between the pre-Christian attitudes, if you go back to the sources, that does not describe at all the type of mentality we see in the examples you gave. For example, there is an article on the Occidental Observer called Hypermasculine Behavior Among Iron Age Scandinavian Men that describes some of this, you know, the pre-Christian attitudes, where everything was about honor, and if you were seen as sort of basically disgraceful, if you didn't exact revenge against those who had wronged you, and it's completely the opposite of the very sort of Christian or meek mentality. So it's not necessarily native to the Scandinavians. I think, I don't know, it's probably connected to the sort of very strong religiosity that is. And it's also, that's also one factor that Norway is far more Christian than Sweden.
Oh, that's interesting. I didn't know that.
Yeah, you know, shops are closed on Sundays, and they have a more of a stronger sort of presence of this, you know, Christian mentality.
Well, what you were saying, though, about them, you know, exacting revenge and so forth, but that was really part of sort of this concept of social cohesion.
Mm-hmm.
Because it was people who went against the social order generally who were subjected to that sort of punishment. if I'm not mistaken, right? So you could say in a way, of course, manifested very differently from how we do it today, but there was still the same concern with enforcing a social order. I mean, that was a healthy social order as opposed to what we have now. But
yeah, yeah. And also, you know, it just insults against personal honor if someone hints that you are acting in an unmanly manner that can, or if an insult of the nature that you're not manly, that could be, you know, equal to the sort of punishment for murder. So those things were taken extremely, probably even sort of harsher than in Rome and in Greece in comparison, you know, especially issues of manliness and strength and things like that. And that's a sort of very clear contrast to what we can see today. So it's difficult to say exactly where this attitude comes from.
Well, we'll get back to contemporary Scandinavia a bit later, but I wanted to ask you a couple of more things. Sure. Well, where would you put yourself sort of politically / ideologically now? I mean, do you think of yourself as more identitarian? That's a very popular word right now, or is there some other way you like to think of yourself?
Well, I actually never use that term about myself. I usually just call myself a nationalist. I'm my identity is Scandinavian, Nordic. That's probably my primary identity. The nations, the countries are secondary to the Scandinavian identity, I would say, because it's the Scandinavian countries share a common destiny and a common culture and a common language, basically, a common spirituality, the same pantheon, the same mentality to a large extent. And I just call myself a nationalist. I don't necessarily put any sort of values about the political government exactly how it should work, other than that the sort of national identity and the national destiny is primary to, or yeah, national in that sense, of course, of ethnicity and so on, is primary to I don't know, whatever else is popular these days with individualism or economy or whatever else. So it's like the destiny of your tribe, your people. And the other things are very much secondary. I think, what's his name? Mason? James Mason, he wrote that we will interior decorate when we have extinguished the house fire. And I like that term. I like that sort of quote, because people start to talk about these details that are very far into the future. And I think it's our job right now is just to sort of emphasize that we have a right, or we have a duty to assert our own will to power as a people, and not sort of ask others for permission or think about, well, what immigration policy is best for the others or things like that. I think our primary duty is to our forefathers who gave their lives to defend our future, and our duty is to our future generations of our children, and what kind of society, what kind of life we want to give them.
Yeah, I think that we tend to sometimes get too hung up on details. You know, where people think that there's one particular concept or label that, you know, everything that falls outside of that is useless, and, you know, they end up just becoming another subculture within an already very, very small community. So I think it's good to kind of keep your eye on the main objectives
that
you just outlined. But, you know, because I know you personally, I happen to know, I mean, you consider yourself to be a Nordic pagan.
Yes, yes.
But is that an issue in your politics, or do you keep that separate from your political mentality? Or maybe it just informs your, like, that's why I would say it with myself, that
yes,
I have my own proclivities, but I would never say, well, we should have a pagan politics per se. But I know that paganism also informs the way that I look at politics. if that makes sense. I don't know how it is for you.
Absolutely. Yeah, I would probably be a lot similar to that. The only thing I would add to what I said just now previously is that one thing that is very important to me is that I don't do, you know, the proxy thing, that I want to fight for Western civilization, or I wanted to fight for this or that. Or that, like I said, that we should have this policy because it's good for this, or that I think we should just be boldly stating our own interests and asserting our will to power. That's sort of one of my sort of main points of what I think is important. As for paganism, Roger Scruton, one of his speeches that I watched, he said that basically what he saw as the most fundamental difference between the left and the right, politically speaking, is that the left or the right is finds meaning and identity, if you like. It finds, you know, you are who you are because of who you are, you know, because you are born into a certain context, you have certain parents, you have a certain situation, you have a certain, you know, life and relationships with others, and that is what constitutes who you are and your purpose in life and so on. Whereas the left finds its purpose and identity in you know, abstract project, or a project that can unite people, that we want to accomplish this, or, you know, and that it doesn't really matter who you are. It's sort of that your identity is decided by whether or not you participate, or yeah, your value is decided by whether or not you participate in this project. And in that way, well, it's quite obvious that Christianity, at least in you know, in the European context, it became relevant first in Rome, when Rome was a multi-ethnic city and empire, and I think that probably the main reason for why it became strong and spread was because in the context of a multi-ethnic place, it was sort of an abstract idea that anyone could participate in, and it didn't matter who you were or your own background, your roots didn't matter, because it's sort of like the primordial proposition nation, if you like.
Yeah, that's an interesting way of looking at it.
Yeah, and you know, so that's what sort of united everyone, and it made it easy for it to expand very quickly, because it just, instead of, you know, like a religion belonging to a people, you know, it just grows by the people growing. It just recruits more and more people, and finally expands to encompassing basically all of Europe. And now now the Europeans have become basically a minority in Christianity. And it's also sort of, to a large extent, made people go against their roots. So in this respect, it is, from the sort of Scruton's definitions of the left and the right, I think it's a very sort of it's the prime example of a leftist project. So I think that our identity is who we are, and it's our roots, and our roots didn't begin when, you know, our roots are go deeper than whatever, you know, abstract ideas or Bible or prophet or whatever our people were converted to, in the Scandinavian case, 1,000 years ago.
Right. The last people to be.
Yeah. So, yeah, so the last people.
To give in.
Yeah. And I would just say that our roots go deeper than that. And I would say that most that is valuable in the Christian tradition was just things that the Christianity absorbed from Europe. So I think we have a European identity, and I think that Christianity was able to participate in a high culture because it came to Europe. It's not the other way around, because Europe had high cultures and brilliant things before Christianity came, and during Christianity and after Christianity. So I don't think it's right. I don't think it's a part of who we are. It's a thing that Europe participated in during a historical period, but I don't think it's essential for Europe at all.
Yeah, I would never call myself anti-Christian, because I don't, if there's somebody you know, in the cause, who's doing good work, and they're a Christian, I wouldn't tell them that, well, you know, we're not going to accept you because of that. But I do feel, you know, when people, and I'm sure you've experienced this too, I've had people come to me and say, well, the only thing that can save the West is Catholicism, or, you know, the only thing that can save the West is Orthodoxy, or some people even just will say, you know, Christianity generally, you know, has to, you know, will always be Christian. And my response is, well, what, you know, help is the church going to give you in that endeavor? I mean, all of the churches, without exception, as far as I know, are only complaining that we're not taking in more refugees and more immigration. So, I mean, they're a vector for the very same neoliberal tendencies that we oppose.
Yeah.
So I don't see where that really gets you. I mean, I accept the argument that, well, yes, you know, once traditionally Christianity, at least in Europe, was a very Eurocentric phenomenon, and that's true, but it isn't anymore. And I, you know, there's no indication to me that that's going to change anytime soon. So I, if somebody feels drawn to Christianity and they want to consider themselves to be a Christian and also fight for the things that we believe in, I think that's fine. But that is, I think, an inherent contradiction, whereas the pagan religions, of course, were always intended only for a specific people. And there's a strength in that, I think.
And I think it's a sort of it gets old when people come with the point that, well, in the 1700s, if you said that someone was a Christian, that just implied that they were sort of Westerners. Yeah, but now Europeans are a minority because Christianity has expanded, and, you know, South America and Asia and Africa, and it's not coextensive anymore at all. So you can't just use it as, well, we'll fight for Christianity. That's sort of just a proxy for fighting for the white race. Well, no, it isn't. It's not at all.
Right, I agree.
And they don't even want it that way, because they want it to be universal. So it's sort of a contradiction of their on their part. That's not what we're fighting for, and yeah, that's not my identity at all. And I think there's also very much to say for basically the Nietzschean critique of Christianity, which states that basically liberalism and Marxism, socialism is in many ways a child of the Christian sort of metaphysic, if we by metaphysics mean that, you know, the most basic assumptions of all our values and so on, and they're definitely related, and it's a descendant, you know, liberalism and Marxism. It's the idea that, well, when you've converted everyone and when you've erased all the classes, then everything will be all right, or when you've like now erased all the races and then racism will disappear, and racism is the root of all evil. Those sort of utopian projects are definitely related to Christianity and the sort of sentimental values. I don't think that in a pre or non-Christian society that people would even comprehend the idea that motivates letting other people come in because of sentimental ideas. People wouldn't even understand that, probably, in a pre-Christian society, that let's just basically be invaded by Somalis because we feel sorry for them. That wouldn't even compute.
No, of course not. But, well, let's get to a more direct way of addressing this problem of universalism that you're trying to do metapolitically.
Yeah.
Through the Skanza Forum. Mm-hmm. What is, I think Skanza's been going for about a year and a half now?
Yes, we started in the beginning of 2017.
And how many conferences have you held so far?
This will be our fourth.
The one coming up next month on September 15th.
Yes. So we had one. The first event was in Stockholm in early summer of 2017, and then we had just a month later we had one in Oslo. And then we had one in Stockholm again earlier this year, and now we're going to do one in Copenhagen on the 15th of September.
And I know Greg Johnson will be there, and Jared Taylor.
Yes.
Matt Tate.
Matt Tate, I believe, is going to speak, yes.
I know you are.
Yeah, I'm going to speak.
And who else is on the docket?
So we have Helmut Nyborg, who is a emeritus professor of psychology at the University of Aarhus and in Denmark. So he's a Danish psychology professor, and he has done a lot of, you know, research on intelligence and basically the genetic heredity of, you know, intelligence and behavior. And he has studied differences between hormones, between races, you know, like testosterone levels contributing to criminal behavior and explaining parts of why some races are more criminal than other. And so he's done a lot of controversial things. And he has also spoken at AMREN before. But this will be the first time he speaks on the Skanza Forum. And then we have Christopher Dulny, who is the founder of the Nordic Alt-Right. And he also has a podcast called The White Pill, Vita Pillret. They're sort of inspired by the TRS guys, I would say. And he used to be budget director for the Sweden Democrats. So he used to work in the parliament. And he is going to speak on the upcoming election, because the election in Sweden is on September 9th. So it's just like a week before the event.
So you're sort of preparing the ground for the coming revolution.
Yeah, well, it's going to be an interesting thing. Just before you called now, I was watching a documentary that's on Swedish television about... basically all the rapes in Sweden being committed by foreigners. And this is something that, you know, the authorities have just denied completely through the years.
It's even been proven that they just cover these things up when they happen, right?
Oh, yes, definitely, yeah, yeah. The one sort of very sort of egregious example is 2 years ago now, a year and a half ago, something like that. There was a... like a 10-year-old schoolgirl who was raped in the middle of the schoolyard by a black, because, you know, they take in blacks and they don't know their age, and they just put them in the class with, you know, regular white kids. And even at the same age, blacks develop sooner and you know, they mature sooner, so they become more adult sooner. And therefore, it should be sort of unsuitable to have them in the same age groups. And she was raped by a black fellow student in the middle of the schoolyard. And the headmaster of this school, or the headmistress, I don't know if she was female, she just covered it up. And when the parents found out, they were furious, of course. But these things happen all the time. That authority figures just cover up all the mess that has been created in Sweden.
Because they want to think that the multicultural dream is just fantastic and it's making everything better, so they can't have anything interfere with that narrative, or
yeah,
that definitely. People might get wise to the fact that maybe there's a hostile establishment.
Yeah, and I think on just an individual level, I think people are just extremely unprincipled. They know what kind of behavior they get rewarded for and what sort of gets them into trouble. So they just play along, and they just know what they just try to do what, you know, benefits their career or keeps them personally out of trouble, and they don't care what happens to anyone else. I think that's a huge thing, because you know that you will be sort of socially shamed if you speak out against something. And they just want to keep their head down, you know, and get on with their careers. And it's probably, you know, just the easiest way out. She wasn't even necessarily politically motivated, I think. It's just like just selfish motives, that this is just the easiest option of the, you know, it's just more trouble confronting this huge problem. So let's just say it, nothing happened.
Well, but I think that this is, you know, people are beginning to see through tissue of lies, because I'm sure you can tell me what the exact numbers are, but I've read that the Sweden Democrats are polling better than ever. It's something like 30% popularity.
Well, at least around 2025, but around 25 have been, you know, the best results that I've seen, and which means that they have a great likelihood of ending up as the biggest party in the Swedish parliament. But The Sweden Democrats are sort of extremely milquetoast and watered down in their policies. But one of the benefits, of course, among many, because one of the benefits is, of course, that they affect public discourse by just making it more legitimate in the sort of lemming mentality that other people think this, so maybe I can complain about it as well. But another thing is that they sort of expose the corruption of the system, because all the other parties basically agree that if the Sweden Democrats get a lot of votes, they will, the left parties and the right parties will cooperate just to keep out the Sweden Democrats, and that sort of reveals their hand, doesn't it?
Yes.
It reveals that the only ambition they have, or the most important, their absolute top priority is just to keep this madness going, no matter what. Anything else, they can compromise with any other parts of their policies, but this sort of mass immigration nonsense, it must keep going at all costs. So even if it means, you know, cooperating with their quote-unquote opponents in politics, because those things are not very important when it comes to keeping this sort of machinery going. So that's one of the good things. And one more interesting thing is that the Alternativ för Sverige, Alternative for Sweden, is a new party. Yeah.
Founded by the former youth leader of the Sweden Democrats, yes?
Yes, because the Sweden Democrats have had these silly purges where the leftist media has exposed someone for saying something politically incorrect, and the party leadership of the Sweden Democrats has just thrown them out of the party, and now some of the leaders have even thanked the sort of the bullies in the leftist media who just keep on bullying the Sweden Democrats. They just thank them for, you know, thank you for exposing the rotten eggs in our own lines so that we can throw them out. So it's, yeah, I don't know, it's a game, but the Alternative for Sweden is definitely sort of very legit, and they might get a lot of votes. I hope they do. I hope they get more than 1%, because if they get 1%, they get all the, I don't know what you would call them, election tickets or whatever, the thing that you put in the box.
the ballots.
Yeah. And they will get them financed by the state, and they'll get some sort of financial benefits from reaching over the first 1% bar, and then they have to cross 4% to get into the parliament, but that will probably not happen in this election. So if they just keep their heads cool, I think they might get in 4 years again, but I sure hope they get as many votes as possible this time, because that sends sort of a very clear signal to this time.
What are some of the main differences in policy between Alternative for Sweden and the Sweden Democrats?
Well, the Sweden Democrats have walked sort of in a very politically correct direction all the time, so they've always watered down their message, and they want to limit immigration. They want to, but they have a sort of very they have a thing they
not
call
stop it entirely.
Yeah, just not stop it entirely, down. And they have a concept called open Swedishness, which means that if you just agree to Swedish values, doesn't matter if you're a Somali or not. It's just completely devoid of any sort of historic or ethnic or any roots of the concept.
Like you sign a piece of paper saying I will abide by these values, or what does that mean?
Yeah, I don't know exactly the procedure, but yeah, I guess that's the sort of basic idea. Whereas the Alternative for Sweden has a complete stop and repatriation program. So they want to, their slogan is that with all the other parties we'll get, 300,000 more immigrants. With us, we'll throw out 500,000. So we'll deport 500,000 of these sort of aliens. That's their sort of slogan for the election. So there's, yeah.
It sounds like they're more what's needed.
I would say so, yes.
Yes.
Yeah. So they speak clearly on these matters, and they don't compromise, and they have the sort of more of a sort of Donald Trump-ish attitude. They don't apologize. They don't take any crap, you know. Mm-hmm. So they attack rather than sort of apologize, which, you know, the Sweden Democrats are they have really sort of they have this fundamental attitude of basically being sorry for existing. They have this extremely weak attitude, and yeah.
People told me that was, I have some French friends who I was speaking to after the election last year, and they told me that was the problem that the Front National had, was that Marine Le Pen kind of let herself get sucked into the leftist narrative of having to apologize, you know, and explain herself on certain issues. And they were telling me she should have been more like Trump and just been like, you know, I don't have to explain myself to you. You know, here's what I stand for, and, you know, you can take it or leave it. So... that's unfortunate that they, although I guess that's pretty common in the West today.
And I think it's a complete misunderstanding of political psychology, because people will respect it. If you don't believe in what you yourself are saying, then no one else will believe it, you know. It's sort of, you have to radiate a very strong confidence to get the respect of people, and it, especially if you're saying controversial things. If you start by sort of, well, saying this is sort of like telling a dirty joke, so I have to whisper it, then people will not feel a lot of they'll not feel a lot of confidence in what you're saying.
No, that's definitely the case.
Yeah.
But I have to say, I know less about what's going on in Norway and Denmark these days. So what does the political landscape look like in those countries?
Well, they definitely do not have anything going the same way as in Sweden. Sweden has a sort of a nationalist movement and has had for decades. Denmark maybe has less of a need for a nationalist movement, because the debate or the sort of social climate and the room for debate is wider in Denmark. But unfortunately, they have a very sort of civic nationalist attitude about these things. They want to integrate the immigrants. Just this summer, a law passed in Denmark that said that that banned burkas in public places. Mm-hmm. So if you wear a burqa, you'll get a fine. And I don't know, probably that sends a signal to some extent, but I fear that the sort of end goal and end result of that is to sort of integrate the people who don't belong here, and that's sort of the opposite of what I want. And that's sort of that's a good example of what's the difference between the nationalism that I represent and, you know, the ethnic people nationalism and just the sort of ideas, civic nationalism, that if you adhere to these or these values, and if you stop the sort of Muslim things, then you're welcome to stay here. That's sort of not what I want. But I don't know, some people believe that this will send a signal that fewer will feel welcome and fewer will come. I don't know. What's your opinion on those things like that?
Well, even though we all, you know, talk about Trump all the time, and, you know, I certainly think he's better than anyone else.
He's better than Hillary.
Could have had from the Republican, or anyone in the Republican field either. But probably, that is sort of still the kind of conservatism he represents. But it's a step in the right direction. It's obviously not the solution. You know, I don't think, you know, burqa bans and those sort of thing, I mean, they don't prevent immigrants from coming to our countries.
No.
So, it's insufficient. But I do have to say, when I was in Copenhagen last year, demographically speaking, it was much better off than Stockholm was when I was there. So it seemed like... Also, I thought the women were extremely beautiful, but that's a side issue. But the city itself, I was surprised. It seemed to be, there was some, well, you know, I went through Christiania just to see it. Is that how you say it?
Christiania.
I went through there. That's sort of like the hippie commune area of Copenhagen. So there was a lot of diversity there, but in the rest of the city, it really seemed quite homogeneous. I was surprised. Pleasantly surprised, of course.
Yeah, and they also have Professor Nyborg, one of the speakers. He is actually allowed one of his debate articles that was published in the mainstream Danish press was called Danishness, Culture or Biology. It's sort of an article that could have been published on Countercurrents or in Amaran or whatever, but it's published in the Danish mainstream press. That would never ever ever happen in Sweden or Norway. So that's sort of an indication.
Sure,
yeah, that's an indication of, you know, the sort of intellectual openness that's still sort of alive in Denmark. It's not as sectarian as Sweden and Norway.
But what about the situation in Norway? Like, I know they have this, what's it called, the Progress Party or something like that?
Yeah.
It's sort of an anti-immigration. I don't really know much about them, though.
No, I don't think you should count on them, really. There is...
Okay.
No, I think it's extreme. It's even more watered down than the Sweden Democrats. By far. So it's not. Yeah, it's nothing to count on at all. So I wouldn't call them nationalists at all. But Denmark has it's very common to criticize Islam in Denmark. That's why I sort of object to these. Wouldn't you think that there is a risk by with these measures, you know, to ban circumcision or ban burqas or whatever? I sort of want them to keep as separate as possible. You see what I'm getting at?
Yeah, I see that. Although I wonder if that's really been working. I don't know. I mean, we have people, of course, wearing burqas in the U.S. too, and they do in Sweden. And I don't know if that's really okay. I suppose I see your point. If people see that more often, it might make them more likely to support stronger.
Yeah,
anti-immigration measures.
It's sort of a safety valve solution, you know. I'm sort of uneasy with those things.
Well, it also gives the government a way to make it seem like they're doing something about the problem when they're really not.
Yeah, exactly.
So yeah, I guess I can see where you're going with that. Yeah, maybe that's true. I wouldn't quite, you know, bring myself to say that I actually think it's wrong, but it's obviously completely insufficient, and it probably is, you know, like you said, designed to, you know, sort of release some of the pressure.
Yeah,
so
eventually integrate people into sort of a multi-ethnic but monocultural whole.
I really don't know where people get this idea. You know, they meet, like, they went to university and, you know, they met, you know, somebody from the Middle East or from Africa or wherever who was, you know, they always tell you, oh, he was a great guy, you know, and they think therefore that means that, well, really they're all just like that, you know, deep down. They can all be like that friend they had at university or wherever. But
yeah.
To me, that just completely misses the point, the fact that these people still represent a different culture and, of course, racially different, that goes without saying, and their mere presence. Like, it's not a question of whether they're nice or not.
Yes.
They could be nice and be in their own countries. And,
oh, definitely.
You know, I'll go there as a tourist and I'll shake their hand and it'll be great. But they should they should stay there and not. I mean, their mere presence in our societies alters them.
Yeah.
And this is even in the U.S. There's a lot of Trump supporters I've talked to. You know, not people in our milieu, but, you know, more mainstream Trump supporters.
Mm-hmm.
Who really have trouble with that? You know, they this idea. You know, they say, well, you know, it's bad to have Muslims because, you know, they don't integrate so well. But
yeah,
you know, like Christians from Africa or the Middle East, well, that's just fine because they'll integrate because we'll all go to church together. You know, it's
well, all the historic race riots in America have not been because of Islam.
Of course, that's the thing. Well, I think that they kind of subscribe to this idea that, you know, the problem with the black population is, you know, it's going to work itself out eventually as we, you know, as we bring them up to sort of a middle class American level, that will all, you know, that's sort of like the mainstream Republican myth.
Yeah.
That, you know, they can sort of be, you know, they'll be brought up to a white middle class level in the U.S. And then, you know, they'll integrate and everything will be fine. You know, it's basically the same as the leftist notion that they're just as capable as we are and they have the same desires that we have, you know, for success and so on, that I don't think is necessarily the case with most of them, but that's, unfortunately, that myth is just as vibrant on the right as it is on the left in America.
Yeah. Yeah, and one of the most problematic immigrant groups in Sweden has been the Christian Syrians, who have been extremely criminal and group-oriented and, you know, hostile to society. But the thing you said about, you know, this one nice immigrant or whatever, and it's an example of the greatest sort of political ignorance to think that politics is about this or that individual.
That's always what they try to bring it down to. Like, if I say that I'm against immigration, you know, that if it's a leftist I'm talking to, they'll always come back with something like, oh, so, you know, you just have to, you know, why do you not like these people? You just, you know, you haven't really gotten to know them.
Yeah.
Yeah, when, okay, I lived in, you know, in India for 5 years, and I had plenty of exposure to non-white people, and it's ultimately not about liking or disliking, because it's like, I'm sure among any immigrant group, there's people I would like and dislike. Even among whites, it's not like I like all white people.
Yeah,
and dislike all non-white people, but ultimately that's not the issue.
That's not the issue, and I've heard, you know, from some people saying that, well, I like to be among these people, or I like to be among the, I have no problem being among these people. Well, it's not about you. Politics is not about one individual. Politics is about society. And it's,
yes.
There's a huge difference between one person and one person being friends and having groups of millions living in you know, grouped together in the same territory, because it's just historically and biologically proven that that creates conflict. And that does not create a place where people feel at home. It creates a place where everyone feels alienated. And that's sort of, and then you get this sort of trivial, horrible modern society. You have to have a place where you can feel at home, and where you have your roots, and where you can live sort of a genuine life. Because if you don't have that, life becomes meaningless completely. And you'll not have, you know, confidence in the future enough to raise a family, and people do not feel comfortable at all in these societies.
Well, a slogan that I like is, you know, a home for everybody is a home for nobody.
Yes, yes.
I mean, if you use the analogy of an actual home, you know, the idea that, well, just anybody could come and crash on your couch and, mm-hmm. you know, you're obligated to accept it just because they want to be there. It doesn't even matter what the reason is.
Yeah.
You know, are you really going to feel safe in that situation? Are you going to, you know, want your kids to be around, you know, whoever just happens to wander in your house? And
mm-hmm.
yeah, it's very faulty logic that people use to try to defend these ideas that I really don't understand.
No, because politics is about how huge groups of people can work together. It's about a dynamic among big groups of people. It's not a dynamics about individuals, and that's the that's the crucial sort of distinction. It's not about, well, I like to be among these people. Well, it's not about you. It's about what actually works, and we have a lot of, you know, scientific empirical data on it. We have historical data on what works and what creates a society where people feel comfortable and where there's very little crime. I think that, just like a very simple example of the kind of society I want, is a society where I don't have to lock my front door.
Right.
And the most likely way to get that is to have a ethnically homogeneous society.
Well, I really don't see very many leftists, you know, moving to Africa or things like that. But if there actually was somebody who said, I prefer to be around these people, then my answer to that would be, great, go ahead. I mean, we have, you know, go settle there, and, you know, I'm sure that you'll be welcomed with open arms.
Yeah, I saw this. Jared Taylor was on the Ramsey Paul show, and he said that, Joseph Sobran was a sort of a quote machine. He just said these things that were just brilliant quotes. And one of the examples he gave was that in their mating and migratory habits, the leftist is similar to the Ku Klux Klan. So it's sort of, if you look at what they do instead of what they say, it's they don't really believe their own things.
Yeah, well, that's definitely true. But, well, I wanted to say a bit more about the upcoming Skanza Forum, though. I mean, there are still seats available, right? So people can sign up. Well, we've put the details on the Countercurrents page a couple of weeks ago, but I'll make sure that that goes into the show notes.
Mm-hmm.
But what would you say, I wanted to ask you this before and I forgot, what would you say sort of is your overall mission with the Sconza Forum? Do you have something specific in mind that you want to achieve, or are you just generally trying to contribute to the meta-political struggle in Scandinavia?
Well, yeah, one of the things that I want to achieve is to bring attention to Scandinavian identity, to the Scandinavian roots. It's not something that we have done a lot of so far, but we are going to bring out books and so forth with that theme. So just, you know, historical roots, and that's, I guess, where some of my views on religion come into play, because it's mostly the sort of pre-Christian roots that I'm interested in, and that I want to promote, because that is what sort of what makes us unique and what gives us a sense of our identity and who we are and our roots. And one more thing is that I want to create, well, obviously the what unites all sort of conferences and so on is it gives you a sort of physical place where you can meet in the flesh world, to use a Twin Peaks sort of concept.
yes.
but, you know, because there is a sort of an autism in our view of how things work. I think Andrew Hamilton wrote an article on Countercurrents a few years back. That sort of nationalists have this misconception about humans, that they actually read these long articles and then make up their sort of minds. So we write these long essays and these books and so on. And they are valuable, but I would say that, yes, we have a rationality and we have an intelligence, but most of all, we are social creatures.
Right.
And that's shown by when society or the politically dominant class does not approve of what you say or what the opinions that you represent. They do not sort of say, well, I disagree with you and here's why. You know, what they do is they try to socially isolate you. And it isn't enough that we speak to other people online or we read things. We have to meet other people to get the sort of social human reinforcement and you have to have human contact, and you have to network with other people, and that's of course not unique for the Sconza Forum. People should go to these events. People should get to know each other and meet in real life, and not just, you know, live online and things like that. And
which is a big problem in our circles.
It is. It is. Yes. Yes. And when you do that, you get a sort of, when you get a real-life network of people who can support you and you feel comfortable among them, then it really, the sort of social punishments that society tries to meet out against you, is that they don't work, because you have your support and all your friends are on your side. You have your community, and you're not dependent on their approval at all.
Yes.
You know, in a social group, if you get expelled from the group, that means death. But that's why we have to create these groups, and we have to become sort of not sensitive. We have to become anti-fragile, was the word I was looking for, toward these sort of attacks against our sort of social networks. And the other thing is that I want to create a ideology, and not just these reactionary these reactions, these sort of short-term reactions against what's going on. I think we need to create long-term plans for what we want, not just, you know, react against the latest thing that the left has invented that, no, we don't like. Yeah, yeah, yes, yes. I think we have to have the long-term goal, and I think that's in many places it's missing. So I think that's an important thing that we need to build. So we need, you know, real world solutions, and I think that's one of our missions to create those, because we collect a lot of intelligent people, and I like to spend a lot of time on these events, not just, you know, giving speeches, but we have panel discussions and Q&As, so we interact with the audience and we sort of discuss the issues that are on people's minds. And it creates a good sort of opportunity to interact with prominent people like Greg and Jared and others. So I think that's one of the main values, that just to come there and be around other intelligent, sensible people, because it's, in the end, it's not about the arguments. In the end, it's about having people that you can relate to around you, who can support you, and so that you
inspire
can,
you, hopefully.
Yes. And that's what we want to do.
Let me just ask you, I'm sure we could do an entire hour on this, and maybe we will at some point in the future, but a couple of times you've referenced the concept of a Scandinavian identity. What do you see? I mean, just if you could give an example, what is something that unifies Sweden and Norway and Denmark? And I've also been neglecting Finland in this conversation. What would you say is something that unites them, but that distinguishes them from the rest of Europe?
Well, Finland is slightly different, because it's not a Finnish is not a you know, does not belong to the same language group, for example.
Yeah, so it's closer to Hungarian, allegedly.
yes. So Finland is slightly different, but I just think that Scandinavia, and I think that most Scandinavians realize this, that we all share a same destiny. It's not about the states as they are now, because throughout history, as I mentioned briefly in the beginning of our discussion, we have shared a destiny all throughout history, and the borders between the nations or the states have varied a lot, and Sweden and Denmark and Norway have been in a union for hundreds of years, and then Norway and Denmark were in a union, and then Sweden and Norway were in a union, and now there's just for the last 100 years have there been three completely different states. And it's the language that is common between, you know, Denmark shares a boundary with Germany, but still it belongs to Scandinavia. Historically, in the literature and in the, not least in the religion, in the spiritual foundation. And so I think that everyone senses that we share a sort of an identity. So that's why I think we share a common responsibility to help each other get where we need to be. And Sweden, I think, has a head start. Even though Sweden is often used as the example of the completely failed state, a mutual friend of ours used to joke and say that Sweden is the Scandinavian Christ, you know, sacrifices itself to show the sort of example of how badly it can go if people don't come to their senses. But I think we should, we need to get sort of a proper sense of nationalism going in all three countries, and I think we need to help each other do that. And when it comes to some people, you know, want a political union this or that way, that's not what I'm into. I'm not into politics on that level. I'm into more sort of fundamental ideas of understanding our roots, because that's how we get a sense of the value of what we're losing. It's by being in our own sort of in our own nature, in our own history, in our own literature, by sort of connecting with your own history, you sort of understand who you are and what's gonna get lost if we just keep flooding these countries with people from the other side of the world because they don't share our roots. They don't share our history. And so that's where, why they never can be sort of a part of what we are. And they can never be a part of our destiny.
That's all really interesting. But let me just ask you, what do you think is a, can you name a specific characteristic that you think defines Scandinavians, that distinguishes them from other humans as well as Europeans? I'm just curious what you think as a Scandinavian yourself.
Well, I wouldn't want to say the Jantelag because it's a negative characteristic, but that's the first thing that comes to mind.
Because we're kind of coming to the end here, so let's go with something positive.
Yeah. No, I think there is a sort of, when we set our mind on something, I think we can have an, extreme will to power, an extreme will to assert our will on the world. And, it's just that is sort of misguided because, Sweden wants to be the moral superpower of the world and wants to ruin itself and commit suicide and everything. But I think if that is directed in the right direction, I think we can become an example to the world, because it used to be that, you know, Scandinavian things were sort of a symbol of quality things and things that work well.
Well, I think it still is in many people's minds.
Yeah, yeah. And I think we should go back to that instead of being an embarrassment for, you know, having transsexuals everywhere and letting immigrants rape our women and things like that. I think we should go back to sort of being an example of positive things.
Yeah, well, I certainly wish you well in that, and it seems like there's already some positive signs brewing in Scandinavia, so I have good hope for the future.
Mm-hmm.
But we've been going for a bit over an hour now, so I think we should probably draw this to a close. But is there anything else you want to add before, anything else that, you know, projects on the horizon or anything that you want our listeners to know about?
Well, if they want to come to the Skanza Forum in Copenhagen on September 15th, please do write. If you know someone who can vouch for you, please do make a reference to that person. Or if you don't, please give me some personal details so I can at least see who you are. If you are, you are not able to register if you're anonymous, because the reason why we have this vetting process is not because we want everyone who comes to the event to be sort of politically approved by us. It's just to avoid the risk of the event being disrupted. So it's not that, some people have misunderstood that. They think that everyone has to agree with us politically. I do not want that. I would wish that libertarians, liberals, communists, what have you, could come. But unfortunately, we have people who just want to harm others who don't agree with them. So they would attack nationalists or whatever. And that's what we want to avoid. So the vetting process is not about, you know, your political opinions at all. It's just about the likelihood of you trying to sabotage the event. That's why we have that process. So please just send us some sort of information, and we'll stay in touch.
Okay. Well, on that note, I think we'll end here. But thanks a lot for joining me.
Yeah, and thank you. And thank you for inviting me. It's been a great pleasure.
And I'd like to have you on again in the future on these, if you're willing.
Oh, yes, definitely. I would look forward to that, yeah.
Fantastic. All right. Until next week, everyone, this is John Morgan, and have a good day.